This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The podcast where we talk to smart people, but not necessarily done by smart people.
That is an awesome question.
This one goes down probably on one of my top five.
Hey, I like nutrition. I like to eat food.
This is the coolest thing ever. We're going to do this forever.
I wish I paid more attention in that class.
You know, I'm going to be honest. I don't understand that. As a man, I don't get it.
Welcome to SmartPeoplePodcast.com.
Hello and welcome to Smart People Podcast, conversations that satisfy your curious mind. Chris Stemp here. Thanks for joining us. Wow, I'm not kidding. I just finished this interview and I went straight into the intro because there were thoughts I didn't want to lose. I don't always do that. Sometimes I record the intro just before the episode airs. It's not saying anything. It's just life and busyness, but I had to get this out. Okay, so first of all, who are we interviewing today? Let's start there. Our guest today is a man named Seth Stevens Davidowitz. Yes, there's a hyphenation there. It's a long last name. And because we get a little personal about Seth's background and how he got to where he is, I want to make sure you know who he is. So Seth, first of all, he's a data scientist. He's used data from the internet, particularly Google, to now get new insights into the human psyche, which shows up in his brand new book, Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. Seth, in his past, he worked for Google as a data scientist and is currently a contributing op-ed writer for the New York Times. He's designing and teaching a course about his research at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, where he is a visiting lecturer. He also received his undergrad in philosophy from Stanford and has a PhD in economics from Harvard. Obviously a smart guy, and his book is incredible. So the idea of this book is essentially Seth analyzes data through Google, basically Google Trends and Google AdWords. Some of you might be familiar with those. But he answers some questions or he uncovers some biases. So let me give you an example. And this is a little bit of a teaser because we do discuss this at the end of the interview. Imagine you have a son and a daughter, and you're in Google, and you type in, is my son, and then go ahead and you fill in the blank. So is my son blank? So of course, this search happens all over the world, right? There's is my son, and then some kind of question. In the same fashion, you have a daughter. And you type, is my daughter blank? It's quite surprising the difference in what that blank is, purely based on the fact that it's either you're searching about a son or a daughter. And I think what's uncovered there and what Seth mentions really shows us how, although as parents we like to think we treat our children, regardless of their sex, as exact equals, we don't, or at least deep down, we don't think of it. You be the judge. It's at the end of the interview. But that's some of the things that can be uncovered through the power of data science and Google. And the title of the book, Everybody Lies, is because oftentimes Google is the truth serum. What we're really feeling, what we're really curious about or anxious about or wondering, we'll put into that little white box in Google as opposed to talk to everyone else about it. If you don't believe me, how many times have you deleted your Google searches because you were embarrassed by them or worried about them, right? So that's the crux of this interview. But here's a few things I really wanted to talk about. First, we spend the first 10 to 15 minutes talking about Seth's background, how he got to where he is, how he became a data scientist. And then that conversation travels into one about the 40-hour work week, 50-hour work week, how scared of that he is. And we all know that I'm terrified of that as well. We talk a little bit about what the data says. And so this is a journey. If you're looking for a clear-cut interview, not happening. Another thing we do in this episode that I've never done before, I pull up a web browser and briefly Seth talks us through how you would utilize Google Trends to find more information about a topic. Specifically, if you are looking to advertise or market or sell something, how Google Trends can start you on the right path. So if you're not at a computer, I've edited it so it's a little shorter and quicker, but it just gives you an idea of how it can be used. And also if you are at a computer, maybe it's fun to follow along. Lastly, I want to say that because of this topic, because of what is incorporated in our Google searches, we do touch on a few things that aren't politically correct. One of the topics actually made me a little bit nauseous, not because it's such a shock factor, it's real life, but it's something that we don't really talk about, something honestly I've never really thought about. And then Seth talked about what the data says about this topic. So if you're a little squeamish, or perhaps if you have really little kids around, I wouldn't play this episode. There's not swear words, but it's just, again, what goes into Google, we don't say to our closest confidant. So you can imagine perhaps some of the topics. And those are the topics covered in his book, Everybody Lies. If you have strong thoughts on this interview, if there are parts of it you liked, parts of it you don't, the structure, the style, I'd love to hear about it. Your emails sometimes help shape the show, oftentimes give us the energy and confidence to keep going. And if anything, help me continue the journey of connecting through a microphone across the world. So please email us your thoughts. We are at smartpeoplepodcast@gmail.com. So just smartpeoplepodcast@gmail.com. You're in for a treat. This is not the standard show, but hopefully you'll enjoy this episode with Seth Stevens Davidowitz on his new book, Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. Well, Seth, first I want to say thank you so much for taking time out and being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we're talking about a lot of things today. You have a pretty new book out. By the way, when did it come out?
2 days ago.
Yeah, that's what I thought, like just now. The book is called Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. And I got to ask you, so I noticed that the foreword is by Steven Pinker. And the cover is a very like Steven Pinker book kind of cover. Is that purposeful? Are all these things kind of in the same genre? Like, well, how'd that work?
That's like, that whole process is beyond me. They just like sent the cover, the title, the cover, all that wasn't chosen by me. I'm fine with them, but it wasn't. The publishers, I guess, do that, and they seem to have all these standard things like animals are a big theme, or fruits, I guess, or like balloons. There are just a few objects that seem to all appear over and over again in covers. So I have animals, zebras, and elephants.
Yeah, that's so funny. And something I'm aware of and kind of joke with some of the authors, like, hey, here's what I think about your title, even though I know you didn't pick it. The cover, though, is pretty good. But I'll tell you, the subtitle, I mean, we've been doing this for about 7 years, and subtitles just keep getting longer and longer and longer. Soon, the entire cover is just going to be words.
Yeah, it just got bought. My book just got bought in the UK, and they cut this subtitle. They made it much shorter.
Anyway, so on to the real stuff. So Seth, you are a, I guess, data scientist by trade, right?
Well, I got my PhD in economics, but I think I consider myself more a data scientist than an economist.
And then I know now, I mean, would you consider your primary job writing?
Yeah, for the last 2 years, it's been pretty much all writing. I taught a class too, but almost exclusively writing.
let's hear about this background. All right. And this is what fascinates me to think about where you are. You wrote this book, which is amazing. We're going to get into that. You've taught a little bit, PhD, all of that, data scientist. When you were, say, 8, did you have some fascination with numbers or, you know, supply and demand or things like that? Like, bring us back to there first.
No, 8, I had a fascination. I talk about this a little in my book. At 8, I have a fascination with basketball and baseball and all sports and being a professional athlete.
Yeah.
That was basically all I wanted. I was not like I always think that I'm like a jock stuck in a nerd's body and a nerd's mind. So that's really all I wanted to do in life, and it was just my obsession. I spent hours shooting basketballs and throwing like baseballs against little nets where they came back, and trying to get better at pitching. So nothing to do with statistics or numbers or economics or anything.
So I love this topic. When did it transfer, or when did it make that shift?
So I'm kind of convinced that actually this is a little weird. I was very good at it. I was obsessed with sports, but terrible at sports.
Mm.
Not terrible, but I wasn't great. Like I was reasonably coordinated, but I was kind of short and really slow. So I was never great. And but I was obsessed. I knew more about sports than anybody, I think, like just about anybody I knew my age. Like I'd listen to sports radio all like evening, when no kid that I knew did that. I was totally obsessed. But there's this frustration because I knew more than everybody else, but these people would show up, like these people, like they were 6'5" and like 200 pounds, and they knew nothing about sports. They didn't listen to sports radio. They didn't have a favorite team, and they just like dominate me and like become the heroes of high school. And it was just so frustrating. And I'm like really competitive, and I just found it so annoying that I knew more than anybody else and was more obsessed than anyone else and was outshined by these people who knew nothing. So I kind of think my career in economics started as kind of this revenge in a weird way, where there are all these like people who are obsessed with economics and supply and demand curves since they were kids. But I think I was better than most of them just naturally. So I could kind of do the opposite of what the athletes did to me.
You know, they say like your true personality is kind of set in your childhood, and the things you did then and the things you thought about and the things you were good at are what you should kind of seek out. And so it sounds like underneath that surface, you actually are true to that core. I mean, it sounds like the thing you were good at, you do.
That's mostly true, but this book is not really economics in any sort of conventional economics book.
Right, but so data.
I transferred a little bit that I did find standard economics kind of boring. And I was struggling with it a lot in grad school, that I just kind of would get really bored and like couldn't really do the problem sets, had a hard time attending the classes. But I was kind of really interested. I think the other part of me that maybe is a little that I also had an interest in was kind of just like the weirdness in society. So like when I was young, I was obsessed with the Howard Stern show and just like listening. I listened to a show, like I watched his show on E! Every night. And like it was like just like all the weird topics he was talking about, like porn stars and sex and, you know, race and all these topics that I felt like were really important, but I just were like ignored in society. And I think so I kind of did move the training I had more in that direction.
If you are interested in sports, listening to sports, all those things, you're probably collecting data, right? I mean, were you that guy that knew the stats of people too?
Yeah, but not as much. I really don't think I was. Everyone calls me like this huge nerd and this huge geek, but like, I think I was just a jock. Like I played sports more than I guess listening to sports radio, but that's not that statistics based. It's right. Just like men arguing with each other.
Right.
So it wasn't that stats based when I was young. It was more just like wanting to be an athlete really badly,
right.
And just finding the physical like challenge and the competitiveness really exciting.
One of the things I find in a lot of athletes is the thing they enjoy most is the flow of it, the getting lost in the sport. Do you still find that flow state or manufacture that in the work you do today, whether it be writing or the research that you really feel like is the spot you want to be in?
I try to. It's tough, though. It happens less than it's happened, and it's the best feeling in the world when you like are working on something, you're doing work, so it's after you're actually producing something, and you have this feeling of flow. It's the best feeling in the world, but it doesn't happen. I'm trying to figure out how I can get that to happen more, because a lot of this stuff is struggle, and I procrastinate a lot, and you know, so it's not. It's like this book was a. I was really struggling on it for a while, and I had to actually go to my parents have a country house, and I went to that with my dad, and he kind of just had to literally sit me down and like force me to write because I was procrastinating so much at one point.
And I want to get into that because there's this myth, you know, you're able to produce this beautiful quality book. You're interviewed all over the place. You've got a great publisher and all of this, that it just kind of, that you're just different, right? That to do this is on such another level. And especially because, look, let's be honest, you have a PhD, you've done a lot of writing in the past, all these things, but it's still a struggle for you. What is the struggle like?
So the struggle is that, but I think that's common. Most people I know, I think it's a myth that there are some people I met who really like work comes easily. And like, I think it took them a while and they just became addicted to it over time. And maybe that does happen, kind of like exercise. If you do it long enough, eventually you do become addicted to it. But for a long period, I think it's just a struggle, more than most people say or admit. Because I think people like to say that they love their work, but that's, I think, working is hard. My natural instinct is to just like, listen to like music or go for walks or hang out with friends or watch TV or go on dating sites or like go on Facebook. I think that's pretty much true for everybody.
It is. Seth, this is why I'm having this conversation. And maybe, look, I don't care if you're like Tony Robbins or not. It's just nice. These are the types of things that people put into Google and don't talk about in the world.
That is a good lean into the book because, I think that is one of the things I've always been interested in because the things that people say don't line up with my own personal experience. So when everyone says they love their job, I worked at Google for like a year and a half. I found it a struggle like working and like this is like the best job ever, right? Like it's a dream. And like I know that fortunately, like I can look at it objectively and say, this is like an amazing campus. There are all these smart people. There is free food and massages and like and stuff. But like to like hear your alarm clock and just like go to an office and sit there and like stare at a computer and send emails and like go and do coding. It is a huge struggle for me. So then I do kind of suspect I'm like, it can't be true that people love their job nearly as much as they claim. And I think this book is about how basically everybody lies about everything, and which is kind of interesting to me and confirms some of the stuff I thought.
Yes, but don't think you're getting off the hook that easy. We are not jumping straight in your book here because this topic fascinates me. And it was why the podcast was started, this idea of work and all that. So have you discovered through either your own experiences or through the internet, through data, the answer to that idea of work, like how people just do it? The thing you described about going to work, sitting down, alarm clock every day, all of that, things that people struggle with all over the world. It's a topic I'm fascinated about. What's the answer? Why do we do it? Or have you said, okay, I'm just going to do it and not lose hope? What do people Google about this? I mean, it's a broad question. I just want to throw it to you and see what you have.
Yeah, I do want to do a column on that or something down the road. But I have looked a little bit in it. You definitely do see people Googling, I hate my job. I hate my boss. What's wrong with me? Like, I hate adult life. That's a big one. I think when people start like going to a job 9 to 5, a decent percentage of people are just like overwhelmed. You do see that in the internet data. The percentage of people that are just like, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah.
Like this isn't what I signed up for, especially because it comes after college, which for a lot of people is like, you know, kind of fun. You don't have to go to all your classes necessarily. You can kind of do it at your own pace and party a lot and play video games. So I think people are pretty shocked by the 9 to 5. The 9 to 5 grind by itself is pretty bad, and then like but then most people 9 to 5 is easy now, right? Like most people are doing 9 to 8 or 9 to 9.
Yeah, well, even let's kind of, I don't want everyone to get too depressed, but call it a 9 to 7. But then 45-minute commutes each way, and then if you throw in, I have a 2-year-old, life just got bonkers. Like I don't understand how people survive this. And okay, so people are searching for this. And what's really funny is I'm actually considering a master's degree in kind of the industrial organizational psychology, this idea of work. And the other day I was Googling some things and looking, I love going on forums. And I found this forum, might have even been Quora, where the question was, you know, or the statement was, I can't do 40 hours a week. And just reading through that, right? And now I'm realizing this is the data that's getting aggregated. So
yeah, exactly. That's exactly how I felt. And I felt that there was something totally wrong with me. Like every time, 40 hours a week, like I just don't even understand. I don't get the 70 or 80 hours a week, because when I start trying 40 hours a week, I'm just like, this is impossible. Right. I don't get how people do it.
Right. So wait, two things. First of all, have you found the answer? Like, what do you do now? And do you feel like, wow, I finally made it. I got out of that and I'm stable and confident in what I'm doing.
Well, so I signed this book contract, which was pretty big and allowed me to just write the book for a few years with a good salary. And then I'm trying to, yeah. So like my dream for me, like what I can be like, wow, this would be an amazing adult life, is I would write books, teach classes, and like go around giving speeches, to like business conferences or whatever. That I find I'm like, oh, that's fun. Like kind of my own hours, not like I can sleep late when I need to sleep late. Not sure if I want to have kids. So I'm like, yeah, that. So I'm kind of like, but I don't. It kind of depends on how well this book does.
Right.
If the book doesn't do well, I'll probably be back to 9 to 5 or maybe 9 to 9. And if I have kids, I'll definitely be at like 9 to 9.
So how's that thought feel? If you're like, I mean, think, and this is such a really relevant topic. We have a lot of creatives, a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of, you know, aspiring entrepreneurs. And so you've essentially built your business, let's call it that, in this book. This is your product. Yeah. And how, you know, I know myself, I'm a sometimes anxious person. I'd put it into the world and I'd be like, if this doesn't succeed, you're telling me I have to go back to that thing I really don't want to do. And the stress would be almost unbearable. Not to put that on you, but so how does it actually feel?
I think I can avoid it. I'm getting more confident that I can avoid it, because I feel like this book is kind of, it's already doing pretty well, and like my publisher is excited about another one, and like I'm with a speakers bureau, and I'm teaching I taught a class that went I think pretty well in business school, so I'm kind of feeling like. And I'm writing these columns and starting to get like traction on that. So I'm kind of feeling like it's going to work out. My therapist actually, it is true. The anxiety is like overwhelming. Mm-hmm. Like for the last year, I've just been getting so depressed about the thought of a 9 to 5 job, like, or a 9 to 8 job.
Yeah.
And getting really, really anxious about it. And my therapist finally just said, Seth, like, you're not going to have, just stop thinking about it. You're not going to have that. Like, you're not going to do that. It's just not you.
Wow.
So, I'm trying to just embrace that philosophy.
Seth, we got to talk more, man. Seriously.
Yeah.
I think this is kind of
fun to talk about. I had no idea this interview was going to go.
Me either.
Because it's something I think about so much. And I'm sure a lot of people do. Well, I know a lot of people do because of the data.
Exactly.
It's just like, yeah, it's definitely a big theme of my adult existence, the horror of a normal job.
Yeah, me too. And I mean, people know, like, mine actually drove me into having panic attacks. Exactly, really? What you talked about. Yeah, yeah. Like going from college to a 9 to 7. And by the way, just like when you said you went to Google, it was an awesome job. My bosses were fantastic. The money was great. All this stuff. It wasn't that. It was just a shock. And, you know, you could say you poor, sad millennial. And that was something I had to get over and just said like, okay, look, that's just how I felt. Right. And then navigate my own way to a point now, which is much different. I kind of speak and teach for a living and do it sort of on my own time. And so, but I'm still fascinated by it. So I love this. And it is a good segue kind of into your book. This idea, Everybody Lies is the title. And essentially, you have gone through Google data, and we'll talk about that, to determine what people are Googling versus what we say to everyone else and what we even say to ourselves. And kind of what we were just explaining, I've never understood that. I'm an open book. It's one of the things. So it is depressing that Google is the place where we can be our most true selves. Why is that? What have you found, or what have you thought about the fact that our best confidant is a white blank screen?
It's interesting. I'm kind of an open book. I consider myself an open book too. Like I already talked about therapists. You talk about panic attacks. Yeah. Like a lot of people wouldn't talk about those things.
Good point.
But I think if I'm going to be really honest, there are like things that I probably, you know, I'm really honest on certain topics, but there are probably things that I like just have Googled some random thought I had that I probably wouldn't admit. And you're probably, I would guess that you're the same way.
100%.
Really,
100%. I'm not going to lie about it. Yep.
That I don't think anybody, you know, we have like an open, like, I agree that you're an open book. You're like different than most people, but I think everybody has parts of themselves that they don't, that they don't talk about. But I think it is, but it is interesting that I think, everybody, I think, tries to put on some sort of front, much of their, through much of their engagements with the world. And for whatever reason, they feel really comfortable typing things into Google. So there are, I think, two reasons for this. One is you have an incentive to tell the truth, right? So I talk about like closet gay men in certain states where it's hard to be gay. And if you're gay, you don't have an incentive to necessarily broadcast this to your friends who may shun you, or your family members who may shun you. You don't have an incentive to tell a survey. You know, you don't necessarily have an incentive not to tell a survey, but you just lean in the direction of not telling. But you do have an incentive to search for gay porn, right? Because that's what you enjoy watching. So that's a big part of why people are honest on Google, the incentives it gives. The second reason, this is one of the most bizarre things in Google that I definitely was not expecting at all, that people type sort of these little confessionals. You type something like, I'm sad, or I hate my boss, or I'm drunk, or, I regret having children. I talk about that in the book.
Wow.
And I think there's I'm kind of like, what the heck's going on here? But now I'm thinking about it. If you think about the tradition of the confessional in Catholicism, the idea that people just like saying things that they might be embarrassed about or feel like is wrong, it does seem like maybe this is just the modern day confessional.
Mm.
I think even therapy has a little bit of that element to it, where frequently therapy is not the therapist doesn't do that much talking. Usually people just like talking. And, you know, I think because so much of our lives, we're just lying, in one way or another, there is something really freeing about having someone, or in this case, in the modern era, it seems some, white box, to type what's really on our minds.
Well, and let me talk about it this way, because I have a feeling it goes deeper than that and you have some thoughts on it. So my first my first kind of, I don't know, thought is, I don't know if it's that people just want to get it out into the world, but that they want to make a connection and feel not alone, right? And so it's the safest way to do that, hands down.
I think that's a big thing too. So like, last night I had a book party, and like, I said all these stupid things at the book party. Like, it went pretty well. It was fine. But I think, you know, just like, there are like five things afterwards that I just regretted I said, because, you know, my friends are there and I'm like, why did I say that?
Wait, that was so stupid.
What were you thinking?
Let's go here. Like, hold on.
I was just like getting really, really depressed and really, really anxious. And like, you know, like, well, you're such an idiot. Like, why did you say those things? And I think I Googled something like, you know, regret, like saying stupid things at parties and going to these forums that you talk about, where people just say like the stupid, oh my God, I said the stupidest things in parties. And you're like, oh yeah, that, like, you're not the first one in human history who went to a cocktail party and said some stupid things. Like, that happens to a lot of people. So I think that you're right. That is a part of it.
And now a quick word from this week's sponsor. If you've ever found yourself daydreaming during the workday or spending countless hours on small tasks, try NutriBoost. NutriBoost is a top-rated supplement made from nootropics, cognitive enhancing compounds that, when stacked in the right combination, give some of the Silicon Valley's best coders and business people their extra edge. They are 100% safe, and in this case, made from natural and potent cognitive enhancers that will significantly improve your focus, concentration, and memory. So for all you hustlers, strivers, and thrivers, anyone looking to get the most out of their lives, count on NutriBoost to increase your productivity and give you the competitive edge needed to conquer any challenge. That way, you can have more time in the day to enjoy the important things in life. All right, for a limited time, NutriBoost is offering a free 30-day supply. That's a $60 value, and all you'll have to pay is less than $5 for shipping. Head over to trynutriboost.com/smart. That's trynutriboost.com/smart to claim your free trial now while supplies last and before this offer expires. Again, that's trynutriboost.com/smart. One more time for you, trynutriboost.com/smart. And now back to the episode.
Yeah, and well, let's go to that for a second. So first of all, you had a party last night. It's 9. We had an interview at 9 in the morning. I guarantee you are not looking forward to this.
I had a TV interview on CNBC at 6, so I've been up for a while.
So TV interview, like they were Skyping you type thing?
No, I had to go to the studio.
Wait. Okay, so you had a party. You're in Brooklyn. What time did that end? Was it like a rager?
No, it wasn't like a... It was like a party for people in their 30s, not a party for people in their 20s. So it ended at like 10 or 11.
So what happens?
It was like a cocktail thing.
At a book, was this like a book launch party, I'm assuming?
Yeah, but yeah, exactly.
Okay. And so you're there, you're talking about the book and some people there. What's the point? You're trying to sell it or celebrate? Is it mostly friends or is it like industry folks? How's this work?
It was a lot of friends. They had a bookseller there, but I think it was mostly just like have a party, right?
Yeah.
I've been spending 2 years just like locked in my apartment, just writing.
Yeah.
So I think my friends are like, you should have a party to celebrate, you know? So I think that was more of it.
Sorry, I was just really interested by that. But so the connectivity piece on going into Google, also, here's the other thing. And I know that although the publisher came up with the book title, it is a theme in your book about kind of lying and whatnot. Is it really a lie if it's just the fact we don't feel everyone needs to know everything we think or they can't help us, right? So there are things that I think, that I wonder, that I question, that no one in my fairly inner circle would have any relevant feedback on, or at least in my opinion. So it's like now I have access to, call it 3 billion minds as opposed to 10.
Yeah, I think it's not as simple as Google is the truth Some people have kind of been making this point. I think they're a little bit right that it's not as simple as Google is the truth and everything else is fake. Because like if you're smiling with your friends and you're, all putting on a front and kind of playing this game where you're not being necessarily like, and playing this kind of social dance, it's a little bit, it's fake, but it's not, it is like a part of ourselves that we play that dance. So it's not, there is some weird kind of truth in there. But I think for me, I've always been interested in like, in the contrast between the things we see and what's kind of going on behind the scenes. So that's kind of why, whatever you call it, whether it's, truth or truth versus lies, I think there is definitely some of that. There are some examples where I think it's clearly, the Google stuff is the truth. But I think it's also just a different part of ourselves, a part of the psyche that we don't usually see and that does reveal itself there.
Yeah. And I have to admit, when I started reading your book, I get into it and instantly I was in agreement. I was kind of hooked because at least once a month, for one reason or another, I'll notice my Google history, mostly on my phone, right? Because it kind of pops up right in front of your face on your phone. And I'll be like, oh my God, I have to clear that history right now. And it's not, this is complete honesty and not that anybody cares. It's nothing terrible. It's just weird, right? Like if somebody saw me Googling, I don't even know an example, but I'll give you an example, actually. I tend to dread sickness. I'm one of those people, those WebMD people. Like, yeah. I have shortness of breath. Am I dying of blank? You know what I mean? And if somebody got a hold of that, they'd be like, what is wrong with you, in my opinion, you know? So I don't know if there's a person on this planet that doesn't understand what you're going after here and what you're talking about.
I think everybody has their... their things on Google, whether it's a medical condition, either a paranoia or a legitimate medical condition, or some sexual preference, or some anxiety or insecurity. I think everybody, I would guess that just about everybody in society has some Google searches that they wouldn't admit to other people.
Absolutely. Okay, so. First, let's talk about this. And I know everybody's wondering this. I'm sorry that it took me this long to get to it. But how do you gather this data?
So most of it is from Google Trends. That Google Trends is like the public interface that they make available to researchers. There's better data. Google also has this thing called Google AdWords, which is more complicated, less friendly, but gives better data. So like I've kind of been using that a lot more than Google Trends, which is a little bit spotty. People can learn to use this data. And one thing that I have to emphasize now that everyone's like, oh my God, is Seth reading my my embarrassing search history? This is, of course, all anonymous and aggregate. So I'm just looking at what are people searching in a given city or a given state or, at a given hour. But I don't know what any particular person is searching.
So I'm fairly familiar with both, but only at a topical level. I'd like to learn a little bit more about how you get into some of the nitty-gritty in both Trends and AdWords. And to do so, I'm going to use an example that is pertinent to, I feel, a lot of people. And we're going to talk about the lying and the minutia as well. But say you wanted to start a business.
Yeah.
Google Trends and AdWords has been widely known as a great place to start to find out who to target, how to target, where to go. Could you walk us through if you were to say start a small business, whatever it might be, a really niche product, like how would you use big data, Google Trends, all this to determine your, say, marketing strategy?
So what would be the product?
The product. Okay. Here's, I'm looking at, my wife bought me a little thing. It's called the money tree, right? It's like a real tree. It's, so say you were selling a new cool, like tree or plant or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Is that a bad example? You can give me a better one. It's just the first thing I saw.
That's fine. That's fine. So one thing I might do is a new type of plant.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So I, I might look at, say, like searches for gardening, and Google Trends would have a topic on gardening. And then I maybe, like, you could actually follow this at home. If anyone's on Google Trends, you could see topic gardening. And I'd click on the United States, assuming it's a U.S. business.
Oh, hold on one sec. I'm going to follow along with you here. I've never done this before. Okay. So for those interested, and this would work for anything. So, okay, you are in Google and you Google Google Trends.
Yeah, Google Trends.
Okay, so you go to Google Trends, pop it up. It's trends.google.com. Okay, so you have this blank screen and there's a explore topics. Is that where I would put it? Up in the top?
Yeah, so type in gardening.
Gardening. Topic. Okay.
And it should come up down that there's a topic for gardening, right?
Right. Yep, I'm here.
So you click on topic.
Oh, wait. Oh, topic. I see. Yeah, yeah, instead of search term. Okay, cool. Topic.
So the point of that is that if you just put gardening the term, it would just give you the one word. It would just give you searches that include the word gardening.
Mm.
But you probably want more than that because you want people to search for garden or gardeners or vegetable gardens or hoe or all these things. So that's why gardening is the better one.
Okay, great. So I see there's interest over time, interest by region.
Yeah, so like first thing you see is there's a big seasonality to it, right?
Yeah,
not surprisingly.
Wow.
So you see that it's higher in it seems to start
like March.
It peaks around March to May every year, right? You see that?
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, and then drops around the holidays, December, people are busy with other stuff.
Okay, what else would you gather from this?
So right away, you kind of have a pretty good sense of when you want to target people, or you could even have a store that's just, if you look at if you actually analyze the numbers, it's basically a quarter as popular in December as it is in like the end of April. So
sure.
You definitely want to, I'd even question whether you'd want a full year round store, maybe even do something else because there's such huge differences in demand.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you'd look at then below that you'd see interest by sub region, right?
Right.
Oh, are you in the United States?
Yeah. Well, I'm in, how do I know that?
Oh, it might say below the topic. It might
say
worldwide.
Mine says worldwide. Yeah. So should I go to U.S. probably?
Yeah, go to U.S.
Okay. So I go to United States now. Okay. So now it's just U.S. Oh, subregion. Very cool. Yeah.
Now you see the subregion and you see what states are into gardening. And like number one is Vermont.
Yep.
Right. Do you have Vermont?
Sometimes, I do.
Do you have Vermont as number one?
Yep. Vermont, Montana, Maine, Washington, Idaho, Wyoming.
Yeah.
Alaska. What's that?
What's number one for you?
Vermont.
What's the highest for you?
Vermont is 100.
Vermont, right. Yeah. So one thing that I should point out is Google Trends works on us, but this is for the really technical people, but
sure.
Google Trends is a sample of data and they take different samples and sometimes show people different samples. So the numbers might be slightly different that people see. So don't freak out, or like you might click tomorrow and all of a sudden instead of Vermont being number one, Montana will be number one and Vermont will be number two, but that's just kind of sampling. If you really need great data, you can average it a bunch of times.
Okay, cool. All right. So you're starting to realize, okay, there's a seasonality. If I'm going to launch in a specific place, maybe that's the place.
Yeah. And you kind of see like Vermont and Maine are really high. So maybe that would be, and then there are basically two regions in the United States that are really into gardening. There's kind of this really northeast of Vermont and Maine. And New Hampshire, they're all in the top 10. And then there's the northwest of Montana, Idaho, Wyoming. They're all really high in the top 5.
Sure.
So they're basically two regions that seem to be more obsessed with gardening than any other part of the country. So you'd imagine that those would be really, really good places to focus your business. And like there are big differences to the point that it's much lower. It's about only less than half as high interest in the states in the places that are lower, like Mississippi or Illinois or Georgia.
Sure. Okay. And so this all makes sense, and I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole, but to get an idea. So how would you have utilized Google Trends in some of the data? Because it seems fairly general, but I could see you type in something like porn and you could say, hey, more people search for porn when it's cold in the north. But aside from that, how do you continue to drill down as you did in your book?
Yeah, I think you Well, a lot of the book is like, so gardening's interesting, like if you want a gardening business, but it's probably not the most, you know, it is kind of cool that you kind of see these two regions. I didn't know that those were two parts of the country seemed to be more interested in gardening than anybody else.
Yeah.
The seasonality, I probably would have guessed, but I maybe didn't realize it was that strong. And so it's, so there are some interesting findings, but I think a lot of the things that are really interesting about Google are the, you know, more sensitive topics like porn or racism. I do a lot on and racist jokes and stuff, or child abuse, abortion, self-induced abortion. I've done a lot on.
Wow.
Like you can actually see that Google, just as they have a topic for gardening, they have a topic for self-induced abortion.
Be honest, I don't even want to search that.
You'll see that it rose in 2011 a lot when abortion restrictions started, and you see that it's highest in places where it's really, really hard to get an abortion. And you see the top searches, they're like, cause a miscarriage, how to cause a miscarriage, how to induce miscarriage, coat hanger, vitamin C,
all
things like this. So that's one where instead of like just the gardening insights, you're like, oh, wow. Basically, I'm convinced that the United States now has a self-induced abortion crisis just based on this Google search data.
You know, we talked about this before I hit the record button, but one of the things you were surprised to hear about your book is kind of the shock factor, or almost the, I definitely don't want to call it disgust, but the difficulty in some of these things. And the topic you just picked is a brutal one. But to your point, and to kind of what we were talking about, these not only can show you how anything, politicians or laws change behavior, but also where it's happening, why it's happening. And that's what you're really saying is the insight we can draw. It doesn't have to be such, you know, disturbing topics, which really that one just kind of made me nauseous. But
sorry.
No, that's okay. But you know what I'm saying? And that's
the thing we talked about in the book is that I'm kind of that before in our pre-interview is that I'm kind of desensitized to this.
Right.
Because I've been looking at it so long.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So I was kind of surprised that some of that people were disturbed. Because, yeah, when I first did it, I'm like, oh, my God. Like, I was doing this stuff on racism and all the racist jokes people are searching for. And I'm just like, oh, man. Like, I didn't know people were doing that. But now I've been looking at it so long that I am just totally desensitized. Yeah. Kind of like a doctor who spends their entire day just telling people they're dying.
Right.
Like, you just get for someone having to do that, it's like the most impossible thing to ever imagine doing.
Yeah.
But if you do it all day, every day, it's just like your job.
Right.
And I think studying some of these darker topics, it's just kind of been my job.
Yeah, no, and you could tell. And that's a good one. Like it's, let me rephrase that. It's not a good one, but it's a unique way to show how this data can uncover insights that affect everything from policy to how we think about the world to where we need to dedicate time or resources or education. I want to, because one thing I do want to cover is some of the specifics in your book, but also how did you also use, and we don't have to go through the web interface, but Google AdWords, how's that different from Trends? And as you said, more insightful.
They give you so Google Trends only gives you rates of searches, but with Google AdWords, you can get absolute search volumes. There are also just a couple. You can drill down into cities and towns. In Google Trends, you can't really do that as much. And there are some other. There are some other reasons that it can be a better data source, but it's not as user friendly.
I gotcha. Okay, so let's get to the real meat of the book. And first of all, I appreciate the journey we've gone on, and I know others will. But I don't want it to kind of overshadow, you know, in your book, the information, and it is jam packed. Like you read a few pages and you're learning about one topic, and then the next few pages is another. And it's this great insight into the mind and the psyche. And I love it. So let's start with this. What was your favorite or at least most interesting discovery in all of this analysis you did?
Let me think. Favorite. Oh, so this one, this thing I'm obsessed with, and I still want to research it more. But I'm convinced. So most people in liberal circles, and I am kind of I should disclose liberal. That there are two critiques I've gotten in my book so far, both of which I was not expecting. One is that it's disturbing, and two is this guy's just so liberal. Like, why do we need to take his stuff seriously? And I hadn't even thought in that way. Like, yeah. I just thought I was, you know, presenting some interesting data studies. But that's a critique I've gotten a lot. So, full disclosure, I do lean a little bit to the left, and I'm not like a fan of Trump, but.
You know, that's kind of the lean of this show. I mean, look, I'm going to be honest, and I don't want to lose any listeners because of it. I totally respect both sides, but just to let you know.
Because I didn't think it was liberal because it's not necessarily the most politically correct book. Like, I thought that, you know, because it goes into topics that we don't usually talk about. And I talk about the sexual preferences of women, which are really politically incorrect.
Wow.
If you actually read what they are.
I have not gotten.
So that's why I was surprised that everyone's just like when I think like of a liberal book, I think of a very politically correct book, but which this is not, but that was a critique.
I'm going to be honest. I haven't gotten to that part yet. And now I'm going to be searching through that.
Most of my friends are pretty liberal. And everyone says how anxious they were or have been about the Trump phenomenon, like when he was, you know, during the election, when it seemed like he might win, and after the election, like, what's going to happen to society? Like, I'm really, really anxious. And I looked at the data, you know, on anxiety and as you talk about panic attacks, like, I think when people have a panic attack, they tend to Google it. If you wake up at 3 a.m. in a cold sweat, I think, you know, you tell Google that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just seeing how much, you know, Trump has increased anxiety. And I basically think he hasn't at all. Like, if you look at these really liberal communities, liberal parts of the country, there hasn't been a rise in anxiety during this whole Trump phenomenon, according to my read of the data. And I think that people like to say that – so I even think of in my own experience, like – when I get anxious, it tends to be very, very selfish. I get anxious that my book isn't going to sell, mm-hmm. or some health condition, or like some relationship with a woman. It's really self-absorbed, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Or some imagined legal problem that's usually just totally in my head. But like I remember even during the Trump phenomenon, I did tell a couple of my friends, like, man, I'm really worried about Trump. Because I think it just sounds better to friends to say that, because you sound like kind of a good person, like, I'm worried about the world, right? Rather than bothering your friends with, you know, is my book going to sell? Like, nobody really wants to hear that. So I just find that really interesting.
Yeah.
Because I think even if you look at surveys, people would just say they're really, really, liberals would say they're really, really anxious about Trump. And I just think it's not really true.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And what the data can elicit there is interesting, because I agree with you on specifically on anxiety. It's really a more me focus. And although it's different, right? You can, regardless of your political leans, you can say I'm anxious about Trump, or I would have been anxious about Hillary, whatever. But I don't think it typically reaches that level of even a smaller but more personal thing. So you're right.
It's kind of like it's almost like a fake anxiety. It's like a game. You say, oh, I'm really anxious. But like then 2 seconds later, you just like watch TV. Whereas if you're like anxious about a health problem, you're anxious about a health problem. Like, mm-hmm. you're, you know, stuck in bed, or you're sweating, or you're, you know, like that's real anxiety. So I think that like Trump related anxiety or world problem anxiety is a little bit of this fake game that people play.
Interesting. So let's go into a couple other ones that I wanted to discuss. First, one of the things I found most interesting is how you utilize the data to discuss differences geographically speaking. So you would have a number of different kind of topics, and almost to fill in the blank. And here's how that blank was filled in different countries. Was there any general themes? Like, did you find, or do you feel like, well, this country is absorbed with how they look, while this one's absorbed with how they live, and this one by how they help others? Are there any kind of themes in general you uncovered?
Yeah, so like, I think health seems to be pretty universal. So and that, you know, I don't want to make a general statement, but a lot of the health conditions people go through are very similar around the world. Hmm. I talk about pregnancy, the symptoms that women search around pregnancy, and they seem to be pretty much the same everywhere around the world. But then if you look at like the questions people have about pregnancy, or the concerns they have about pregnancy, or the rumors that spread, those are just all over the place.
Really?
So I think that's a little bit of a general theme, where there's kind of this fixed biology. We're all kind of going through the same thing. We're all having the same, very similar experiences, but then the culture can take it in just wild directions of what particular concerns we focus on, or what's considered a big problem, or what isn't a big problem. That's kind of a big theme. And then the sex stuff, you definitely just see that's where things are all over the place. The degree to which countries can just seem to develop some fetish. And that's really interesting. Why can a country develop a widespread fetish?
Yeah, that is unique. One thing I think your book also uncovers is gender differences in general. So the one that I kind of found pretty shocking was how parents really search about their kids. Being a fairly new dad of a son, and we talk about, okay, if we have more kids and the next one's a daughter, great. You know, it'd be nice to have both. And then your book made me think, oh my gosh, I hope at my core, I really would view them as equal. And your book made me kind of worry about that.
Yeah, so that's the idea. The searches that start is my son. This is with Google AdWords. The searches that start is my son versus is my daughter. That parents are more likely to use to use words like genius or gifted when they say is my son. And when they ask questions about their daughter, they're more likely to say things like overweight, or just focus on her appearance. How can I get my daughter to lose weight? So I think parents like to think that they treat their sons and daughters equally, but I think they tend to be more excited by the intellectual potential of their sons, and more concerned about the appearance of their daughters. Though I hope that as more people read this, they'll change that, because I think parents don't want to do that. They might not be aware of these biases. And as we shed light on them, we can maybe hopefully change them.
Yeah. And that was one of the things, actually, your book initially, and maybe I'm a little bit jaded, right? We do a lot of interviews, but not only that, for every interview, there's five topics that get sent to us. And eventually it's like, okay, I understand it, but like, why? What's the purpose other than entertainment, which entertainment is great. But then once I kind of started looking at some of these more in depth, it was like, well, hopefully it will illuminate things we didn't know we were doing, things we didn't know we felt, or the biases we had, or we don't understand global trends, or, all these things. This one specifically, and maybe you go, wow, I need to be cognizant of that.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's just huge value in knowing the truth about things. I talk about another example, sexual education, how sex ed can incorporate some of this. We've kind of been flying blind in sex ed about what people are really concerned about and what people are really worried about. And I think some of the Google search data has already changed what we know about some of the paranoias that teenagers have around sex, and things that they might they definitely should be told. I've talked to a lot of people in sex ed about incorporating some of this data into their curriculum.
It is. It's fascinating information. I think your book unveils, really pulls back the curtain about new ways to look at what our data and what our searches can tell us about who we are, and really hopefully be used in a manner to maybe steer our thoughts and actions in the way we want them to. But not saying that was the point. It's really uncovering it and discovering it is the first step. So Seth, first of all, thank you so much for being on the show. Thanks for the great conversation. The book is Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. Where would you like people to go? What action do you want them to take? To buy it on Amazon? Go to your blog? Tell us what you want.
Yeah, but go buy it on Amazon if they're, yeah, buy it on Amazon. And if they, yeah, I guess that would be best. Buy at or a bookstore, or I don't know. I don't know what's best for if they now want to help me avoid working a real job my entire life. I don't know what the best way is to improve the rankings on this book. I'm not totally sure.
Come on, you're a data scientist.
You know, I just, yeah, if they're interested, definitely hope they pick it up. I don't really care where.
Well, we'll help you out with that. We'll put a link on smartpeoplepodcast.com and it'll go straight to your book as well as in the post. So Seth, I know that's you're great. Busy. You have a number of interviews. Go ahead and get your coffee before the next one. And just thank you again so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Chris. All right. Talk to you soon.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Seth Stevens Davidovits. Seth's book, Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are, is available on Amazon and at your local bookstore. As always, if you're purchasing on Amazon, please use the Smart People Podcast Amazon link located at smartpeoplepodcast.com/Amazon. This will send you over to Amazon and you just do your shopping as you normally would at no extra cost to you, and we get a nice little kickback that helps support the show. If you're looking for other free and easy ways to support the show, you can always head over to iTunes and rate and review the show over there. If you want to reach out to the show, you can email us at smartpeoplepodcast@gmail.com or send us a message on Twitter @smartpeoplepod. If you're looking to stay up on all things Smart People Podcast, you can always head over to the website smartpeoplepodcast.com and sign up for the newsletter over there. All right, that's it for us this week. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode. We're looking forward to the next. We've got a lot of great interviews coming up. So we will see you all next episode.